You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet,
and story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You're just going to listen to Alex Dormont's
Hot Texas Swing by the Hot Texas Swing Band.
And we're doing Hot Texas.
Yes, and we really love that Alex has given us the courtesy to open and close every show with that great song. So we're delighted you're with us tonight for episode 157. If you're watching live, it will replay immediately on LA Talk Radio's Facebook page, Rendezvous with a Writer's Facebook page, and LA Talk Radio's YouTube page. And then we will have it up shortly, the Audible version up on Podbean, so that you can watch or listen to it over again and again and share it with your friends.
That you have no really excuse to not see it.
Yeah, you have no excuse to not see it. So, Jim, who do we have with us tonight?
We have a house full.
Oh, we do. We have a house full of award-winning historians.
We have some great ladies here, some great writers.
Let's bring them on. First off, let's welcome Jane Little Bodkin. Jane, here she is. Hello, Jane.
Where are you, Jane? Where are you joining us from?
Well, about 8,500 feet up on a mountain in the White Mountain Wilderness in Lincoln County, New Mexico.
Yep, New Mexico. She's like a neighbor.
Yeah, I'm on the Billy the Kid loop. Only, you know, he rode down the hill. I'm up on the mountain. Yep. So
we're delighted to have you. This is your third appearance with us, I think. We're delighted to have you tonight.
Thank you.
And we're being joined next by Lynn Downey. Lynn is coming back for a second time. Hello, Lynn.
Hello, Lynn. Okay.
Welcome. And where are you tonight?
I'm at home in Sonoma, California, otherwise known as the real wine country.
Very good.
And Lynn is back for a second time, and we're delighted to have you returning. So fun, Lynn. And then we have
Janelle
Maloney. Hey. Here she is. Oh, what a nice big
Good to see you.
Hello, Janelle. Welcome to your first time with us. I know it won't be the last. Welcome, welcome.
And where are you, Janelle?
Oh, I'm in a tiny suburb of Phoenix called Ahwatukee.
Ahwatukee. How do you spell that?
I'll just say it was Phoenix.
Add it to the text later.
Phoenix is good.
Well, we are really, really, really happy to have the three of you. You know, back in February, I saw a Facebook post that announced that the three of you were taking a booth together at the Tucson Book Festival, and you were going to have a banner that said the Hottie Historian Collective, and I thought, my gosh, we have to have them on, the Hottie Historians. So, Janelle, will you take a moment and kind of tell us a little bit about your book first? Because tonight, I know I'm doing this a little bit out of order, but here we are. We're live and having fun. So the book that we're going to be talking about tonight is one of the books is Janelle's book, Poems from the Asylum. Tell us a little bit about the book and then tell us about the Hottie Historian Collective.
Sure thing. Poems from the Asylum is a look at my great-grandmother's experience. She's a poet and she got locked up in an insane asylum for a strange medical condition. And then while she was inside, she was writing poems, and they're all like little short stories, and they're all factually correct. So they are eyewitness accounts of what was happening. So the story kind of analyzes and vindicates the people and the experiences that were happening inside. And the haughty historian thing comes from, I think, lovingly, very lovingly being teased for being a youngster in this genre. And I was called the haughty historian. And instead of having my feelings hurt, I said, you know, that's exactly right. That's exactly who I am. And I trademarked it. And it has been a boon. It makes my content more accessible. And it also kind of takes the pressure off of trying to be something I'm not. And that is why I've connected to these other hotties that I think just radiate and sparkle charisma, confidence. And I just love them because they support me as a youngster.
Yeah, I've got to agree with you. How fun. All right. So let's see. Let's talk about. Did you want to do a bio engine? I got us all out of order.
Did we talk about Lynn yet?
Not yet, but we didn't do the bio one.
You want me to do a bio?
We're going to get back on track. I thought this was going to be fun.
Jane's either.
No, we haven't done Jane or Lynn yet. Start with Janelle. Will you just tell us a little something about Janelle? And then we're going
to... I don't know if I want to start with Janelle.
And then we're going to move on to Lynn. Go ahead.
You upsetting Apple Cars?
No, we have so much to talk about. This has been 3 weeks in a row now I've been flustered this way.
Okay, Janelle, right?
Yes.
Janelle Maloney, national award-winning author, news journalist, and original audio historian. She hosts the Women of Wyoming Then and Now interview series and writes about women, wars, and the West. Recently, she has been credited with pinpointing Wyatt Earp's first gunfight.
Yeah. Right. And I think Janelle will be talking about the next time you're on with us October 30th.
Yeah, okay, so come back.
So I'm going to get it right now. So let's do Lynn Downey. Hello, Lynn. And now you're going to tell us a little bit about Lynn.
Okay. She's award-winning historian, novelist, and short story writer. She was a Levi Strauss & Company historian for 25 years and wrote the definitive biography of the company's founder, Levi Strauss, the man who gave blue jeans to the world.
And our question for you, Lynn, well, tell us a little bit about the book we're talking about tonight. I'm going to hold that one now, which is the Arequipa Sanatorium, Life in California's Lung Resort for Women. Tell us a little bit about that book, and then we have a question for you.
Okay. Well, this book began really when I was a child listening to my grandmother's stories about being in a tuberculosis sanatorium when my father was a little boy, and I spent about 30 years researching, living, working, researching, and then finally the book came out in 2019. And it's a story not just of my grandmother, but about this unique institution that was just for women, which was incredibly rare, and founded by a doctor who was inspired to take good care of women by his mother, who was also a physician and surgeon.
Mm-hmm. So, like all of the books of the three of you, it's a really engaging read, and you take us all the way back to even the history of the family and also of that doctor and his family. And it's wonderful. So our question for you, Lynn, is, do you want to ask it?
The question for Lynn. What other question?
Okay, Lynn, you mentioned four women that come to you in a dream. And what do they say? And tell us about that event in your life.
I'll keep it short. It was the fall of 2006. I was working on the book. My grandmother had been in a nursing home for a few years. She was on my mind. And one afternoon during a nap, I had a dream that I was by the tunnel that is the last tunnel before the tunnel before you get onto the Golden Gate Bridge. And there were some boulders off on the right-hand side. And these four women stepped out from behind the boulders. They were dressed in long black skirts and white shirtwaists, like women of the 1910s. And I knew how you know things in dreams, that they were from Arequipa. And they turned and they all looked at me and they each said to me, please tell our story. And 2 months later, my grandmother died. And I knew I was on the right track.
just a remarkable
story. Quite a story.
It's just a remarkable
story.
It
gives me chills. I can definitely relate.
Yeah. All right. Now we're going to move on to Jane Little Bodkin. Hello again, Jane. And Jim has a little something about Jane to share.
National award-winning author Jane Little Bodkin melds personal narratives of American families with compelling stories of Western women. A member of Western Writers of America since 2017, she judges entries with the WWA's prestigious Spur Award, reviews new releases, and writes articles for various magazines. She is a two-time Spur Award winner herself. Very good.
And I know you remember the question because you came up with it.
Who ate the cake?
I did. All the panhandle and all of West Texas.
Oh, my gosh. This book is filled with, and we're going to get into more of it in a bit, but personal memories that are, you know, you just flip the pages. It's a who's who. It's just so emotionally authentic. And so your whole little section on the pageant contestants eating the cake, I remember when we were reading the book, did you read the part about the cake? So we had to ask you.
Well, it's funny because the book is really, everybody here has talked about family. And I came from a dysfunctional family. I had a cheating father. And Lynn and Janelle know this because I told them last March, but shortly before I saw them, I found out I had another brother. And that's happened since this book has come out. Yes. And so I grew up in a situation where my mother wanted me out of the house. I was the enemy, and I was thrust into this pageant. And it's not just any pageant. I was the first Gyrex girl, which is also trademarked. And these two gay men came out in El Paso in a time when you really didn't do that. And they bought this pageant, and they ended up producing 6 Miss USAs, 5 in a row, and made international fame because they sent the girls from Texas who won the Miss USAs, these 6, to the Miss Universe pageant all over the world, dressed in Tony Lama boots, chaps, bolos, the whole bit. Yeah. And intertwining through that is me, the first one that they learned on while this is going on at home. And they thought girls should be skinny like Twiggy. Now I'm dating myself, Janelle. But Twiggy was very, very thin. And
I remember.
That's what they wanted. And I wasn't allowed to eat. Yeah. And so one night I gorged on a sheet cake with my sweet mates. It's the size of a big banquet table. And I did. I ate all of West Texas because I was from El Paso. And I ate all the panhandle because that's where I was born. And that's one of the funny, lighter scenes in the book because there is a lot of, you know, sadder things that happened.
But, you would think there might have been a lot of screaming, you know, when somebody realized,
oh, there was
the cake.
I saw Texas accent, my cake. And that's all we left was her. She did get Miss Congeniality for bringing the cake.
You know, there was a lot in a book, you know, and the detective, the one with the hooks for hands.
Yes, J.J. Arms.
He's an amazing guy.
Yeah.
He died this year. Yes, he finally
just
passed
a while
this year.
Ago, that's right.
Yes, I actually remember seeing that in the news. Well, according to Janelle, all three of you have dipped into your own family histories to give voice to some incredible characters with mysteries or scandals to their name. We are going to take our first little break and to honor our sponsors, Blue Cottage Agency. And I know more than one of us is very connected to Blue Cottage and Clicks by Madison. And maybe you'd like to increase your social media presence or refresh your website, or like we did, launch a website or landing page. Our sponsors, Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, are standing by to assist you. They have exciting news about a new feature offered to writers. Why not take advantage of it? And when we come back, Ms. Nell is going to, I believe, read a poem from her books, Poems from the Asylum. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Authors, welcome home. Every author needs a website, a home base for their brand. Professionally showcase your books and brand with a custom website landing page starting at $369. Bluebookshelf.com. It's a great feeling to be home. Contact the Blue Cottage team today to get started.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. We have several people on tonight. If you have missed us so far, Jane Bodkin, Lynn Downey, and Janelle Maloney. And right now, Janelle is going to read one of the poems from her book, you know, Poems from the Asylum.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. So I'm reading a poem called Forsaken. And in this, Martha Nash, she's been at the asylum for 1 year, and she's wondering, what did I do to deserve this? And why can't I come home? So she writes, all alone, I lie forsaken, and you do not hear me scream. In my everlasting torture, while in peace, you lie and dream. Have I messed your life forever? Am I now where I belong, in this dark and haunted barrack? For I've done the world great wrong. And she's really questioning, why am I still here? Why am I stuck here? Why can't I ever come home?
Oh, wow. Yeah, wow.
This is a great collection of poems. I'm really surprised. I can see how she wrote the poems to kind of keep herself going in this atmosphere of 6.5 years. But she's a really good writer when it comes to poems.
Thank you. She's an award-winning poet, not just in our time, but back in her time as well. So I think that writing gene kind of found its way down to me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So now we're going to have some questions. And do you want to
have a question? A minor theme was secrets. You know, as we talked about before, and as we uncovered some of these secrets, was it easy to write about them?
And who do you want to address that to first?
I address it all three ladies.
Well, I know, but somebody could get it started.
We'll start with Janelle.
Okay, Janelle. So the question that, can I go ahead and paraphrase?
Yeah,
what
you can
said?
Go ahead and paraphrase.
So how did you decide if there was a secret or a mystery, and was it worth investigating and writing about?
I learned that great grandma was at the insane asylum from my grandfather, who just sort of brushed it off. This is something we don't talk about. We don't talk about why. It's very embarrassing and shameful that the family has someone that's crazy, even if I think the diagnosis is wrong. And so I had to do some looking sort of behind my grandfather's back. And when I got into it, I saw her name plastered all over the news in the U.S. and Canada, because she claimed she didn't eat or drink for 7 years. So that really amplifies, like, okay, maybe she really is crazy. That's impossible. So I had to know, what is this? Did she really do that? Was she crazy? Was that real? And I kind of had to just skirt around hurt feelings in order to do that until it was safe to put that all out there for the public.
Yeah. Yeah. So Lynn, the same question. Do you need us to say it again?
No.
Okay, good.
Well, the time that my grandmother spent in the sanatorium was 14 months from 1927 to 1929. My father was 2 when she went into Arequipa. So, of course, the whole family knew that she'd been there. But the secret really was, once she came home, okay, you're cured. Let's get on with life. So there was this feeling that we're not going to talk about that. And she didn't really want to talk about it, at least for a while. But until I came along, teeny tiny little historian who asked all kinds of questions and then sat her down in 1984 with a cassette tape recorder and sat her down and asked her questions for 2 hours about her experience at the sanatorium. So I was the recipient of the secret of what the real experience was. And there were some things I think she didn't want anybody else to know, but she shared them with me.
And did you find that you in turn shared them in the pages of your book, or did you keep them between her and you?
I shared them with her permission. And there are a couple of people still with us in the family from her generation who were so gratified to know that at the, at least in this point in their life, that they knew what she'd been through. They felt badly what she'd been through. They were really happy to know. So that was that she wanted to spread that information on, and I was willing to.
Yeah. And Jane, was there a secret or a memory? What got you started on writing the pink dress?
Well, before I do the pink dress, you held up the Frank Little book just a
minute ago. Yes, I sure did.
That was
the reason I wrote that book was because my family had a secret. They would not talk about Frank Little. I was told he was a socialist who was hanged from a telegraph pole in Butte, Montana on August 1st, 1917. My son brought in a cartoon from an AP US history class of him and that he had to write about. And I knew I had to find the story. And it was one that everybody did shut up. And I think in my family, I was just listening to one of you, I think Lynn said about being safe. We just, the Little family, we didn't talk about things. That journey took me 6 years to get the truth and the whole story on him. And the surviving Littles that were my grandpa's age were thrilled that I finally told it. But their parents had made a pact not to talk about it. Wow. Because my great-grandfather, the FBI, arrested him and put him in prison. And my other uncle went into prison. And all of this was during the first Red Scare, during World War One. And then the Jane Street book that you had there, I think a lot of us tend to go toward these. That, again, was another Union story. And I was interested in that because I found out my grandmother was a maid at the same time Jane Street was organizing. And she, I found out, my family, again, kept this a complete secret. She was married off when she was 15 to a 33-year-old Norwegian in Iowa, and she ran away from him and hid in a mansion in Boulder while this was going on. And I talk about this sort of thing in this book. But on the pink dress, that was one where it was my COVID book, and I never intended to write this or tell everything. And some of the things I told my husband did not want me to tell. And one of the things I told my sons refused to read. I know that's coming later. But the secrets about my mom and my dad, I knew. And when I went back and I started writing this, it just all started bubbling up. And I was able to, because it was a story 50 years ago, I could now look at it and detach myself as a historical figure during the counterculture period. And that's real different on a memoir, you know, to another nonfiction biography or history. But I still wrote it with a historian's eye.
Yeah.
You know, following on that, on the secrets, the family members that were still around, did they have a problem with them, or did they really care? What you wrote.
Who do you want to address that first? To Jane.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Everybody has passed. I didn't write the pink dress until my mom had died. And it was cathartic for me. My brother has finally read it. My cousins have read it. My sons refuse to read it because of an aspect that's in the book. And my husband reads everything I write, chapter by chapter. He's my best person. But my friends, who were my friends at that time and all the way through, this was a big, big deal for them, too, because they see themselves in this story. But family members, I don't have daughters. If I had daughters, maybe it might be a little different. But boys are different, and they're protective of their moms. And there were some things that really upset them. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, Danelle, you know, how did the family members take your book? Assuming that some were still there with us?
Yeah, there were several living relatives to Martha Nash that I was able to consult with, and they had more to share. They had been shut up in this process, and they were so excited that someone actually wanted to know what happened. And so because I guess that first generation has already passed, that next generation down said, oh, finally, we can talk about it, except for my grandfather. He really was so uncomfortable. And he did provide information and stories, but it was very reluctant. And so I did wait for him to pass before anything went public. And that's just a matter of respect, I think. There's something to like the third generation, where the first generation, they can sue you for writing about them. The second generation, they can sue you because their reputation is being damaged. This is their father, their mother. The third generation can't do anything. So third generation, go for it.
You mean we can have all these lawsuits?
That's a really good tip. And what about the same question for Lynn?
No, as I said, family members were really happy to hear the full story. I think it made them love my grandmother even more, knowing what she'd been through, but kept it to herself because she just wanted to move on with her life, which she did. She was given 3 months to live when she was 24 years old, and she lived to be 102. And that is completely directly attributable to the care that she got at Arequipa and what she learned there about taking care of herself. She was obsessed about her health for the rest of her life, and obviously it worked for her.
Yeah, she took the lessons home. Yeah.
You know, I want to ask you two ladies a question again. We'll start with Janelle. It seemed like in some cases, depending on who was doing getting somebody into the facility, that if you had a husband and a doctor that kind of agreed, boom, you could be in real quick without much defense, I guess, right?
Yeah. Although what I really enjoyed in the process of researching this, and you're right, her husband went to a doctor, consulted with him, signed the forms, took it to the judge, and that was it. Martha was arrested with no examination whatsoever. But what I did found, and I love it, I didn't have it at the time because there's time frames of when you can actually get medical and court records. So after the book was published, I learned that Martha Nash went to court by herself without her lying, cheating husband. And she petitioned for her certificate of insanity, which is real. Like, you know, you hear that, oh, they're certifiably insane. No, it's real. She proved herself to the judge that she was not insane, never was. And they canceled that and they gave her a restoration of capacity. And then she took that, which gave her legal rights, and divorced her husband promptly after. And I thought, okay, girlfriend. So I loved that part of the research. You're right. It's tricky for women back then.
How did somebody get into the tuberculosis sanitarium, Arequipa? Did you have a doctor have to sign you in, or could you actually go to the facility and say, hey, you know, I think I got TB?
You had to have a doctor submit your x-rays to the superintendent and then up to the founder, Dr. Philip King Brown. And if there was a bed, you got a bed. And, you know, people were clamoring to get in. My grandmother was considered terminal. My grandfather took her to San Francisco and saw Philip King Brown, the founder of Arequipa, himself. And he said he examined my grandmother, took my grandfather in the other room, and said, your wife has 3 months to live. We don't take terminal patients into a sanatorium. And Papa said, would you please just take her for the 3 months she has? If she doesn't improve, I'll take her home to die. And he broke his own rule and admitted her that very day. And within 3 months, she'd gained 30 pounds. She was on her way to recovery. And as I said, lived to be 102. So that this book is also a thank you to Dr. Philip King Brown for founding Arequipa, which saved my grandmother's life. I wouldn't have had her in my life if it wasn't for him.
Yeah.
I think the beds at Arequipa are so much softer than at the St. Peter Asylum and of the tent city that we have here in here outside of Phoenix and Tucson. Yeah. That, what do they call it? Tentville or Lunger Hill or something.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'll tell you, Janelle, the one thing you had to have in a sanatorium was fresh air. So there were no windows. There was nothing but open screened wards. And Grandma said it could get so foggy, it's very foggy in Northern California. Mm-hmm. The fog would come through the ward and she couldn't even see the bed next to her. It would just come through. They would put newspaper between the mattress and the bed spring so the cold wouldn't come up through the bed.
Yeah.
And Lynn knows.
Go ahead, Jane.
Sorry. I was going to say, Lynn knows this, but my grandmother died in a sanitarium in San Angelo, tuberculosis. Yeah, we all had this.
Oh, wow.
We've talked about this before. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Lynn's book is very interesting to me. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
We're going to take another very short break, and we're going to step away to tell you one of the places that you can order the books from our author guests, including all of tonight's featured books. Find these books and more on the Out West Shop affiliate page on bookshop.org. And when we come back, Lynn will share a passage from her book, Arequipa Sanatorium. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Lynn's going to read a passage from our book here.
Thank you.
Arequipa. Have I got that right?
Arequipa. All right. Lynn, take it away.
Right. In 1917, Philip King Brown asked the patients if they would like to start a sanatorium magazine, and they jumped at the project with as much vigor as they were allowed. They called it Arequipa Gossip, and each ward took turns editing the little paper. Writing was not only a creative activity, but it was also educational and could even lead to post-sanatorium employment for women who showed aptitude with a pen or a typewriter. And under proper supervision, the work wasn't strenuous enough to interfere with lungs at rest. High Life succeeded Arequipa Gossip in September of 1921. Typewritten and issued every 2 weeks, it dealt mostly with the health and antics of the patients and residents, and I do mean antics. News about women who had recently left and reminders of Philip King Brown's pep talks and pet phrases. The first issue reported that many patients were learning shorthand, and the unnamed editor suggested that everyone get together at the same time to study. She ended her piece with, as Dr. Brown says, make Arequipa a school. Doctors such as Philip King Brown might have hoped that in-house magazines would be uplifting, but nearly all the short items in High Life's columns read like the Laughter the Best Medicine column of Reader's Digest. Many patients had nicknames, and the first issue of High Life included a story about a Mrs. McAlpine known as Ichabod Crane. Caught kneeling at the end of her bed and looking through the bars one night, she quipped, bars and bars, but not a thing to drink. This was followed by an editorial comment. We're sorry, Ichabod, but the drinks weren't in the bargain when you came up to Arequipa.
That's funny.
That's funny. Oh, that's funny. Thank you, Lynn. I have a question. Actually, I have a question for Jane. And if it's okay with, well, you don't know, Jane, I'm going to read something aloud that was from your book. I'm hoping this will be okay with you. Memories can be beguiling when good. If you have the luxury of time to puzzle the memory pieces together for the mind's eye, even after all the work is done, the memory may still be faulty with omissions, each rumination colored with emotion. But if the memories are abnormally jagged like shards of glass, and you must digest them suddenly, they may force unwelcome pain, repugnant smells, and even gut-wrenching fear to bubble out into your reality. This is what was happening to me. Your book is so close to the heart, isn't it? My question is, how do you, and then we'll ask it of both of our other guests, but how do you deal with the emotion and yet somehow be able to write it in such a way that you're a little detached from it. I'm not sure that's how to ask that question, but how did you approach that
excerpt? That excerpt is the very one, my boys will not read the book. I was sexually molested when I was a little girl. And that I did not realize, well, I did after I got married, I realized how much that impacted me. And then when I was writing my book, that I remembered back to that exact moment. We were going for dress fittings and Guy and Rex had asked us to strip down to our slips. And I was like, what? And that's when I found out that they were gay and it didn't matter. But I had to try to figure out how to tell that emotion that I was feeling at that moment. And I think that moment is the most emotional. And then at the very beginning, when I realize I forgive my mother for what all had happened after she had died, I start off with that and it's emotional. But yeah, it's hard to do. And you have to, I had to discuss it in the abstract, kind of, to actually do it and then make it tangible at the same time. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah.
In that description. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Jane. Janelle, did you have situations that were, again, painful, but you figured out some way to either leave it out or write about it?
Yeah. So my great-grandfather who locked Martha up was definitely, in my opinion, in my historian opinion, just looking at the facts, he lied, he cheated, he was neglectful, he did things that nowadays we would say was extremely toxic person, and it's great that they got a divorce later. But the children just can't, they can't think of their grandpa like that, because to them, they experienced him differently. He was nice and generous and all of these things. After the divorce, I mean, we're talking years and years and years. He's a totally different man at this point. So they could not wrap their heads around, you're saying these mean things about my grandpa, and I never knew him to be like that. And there's a little bit of a middle ground, but I had to land at, well, here's some facts. I'll hold back on some of my opinions, but fortunately, a lot of women who read it come to the same conclusion, because we can read between the lines. So her feelings are not, you know, facts don't care about your feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. And Lynn, same question for you.
I had a different experience. My overwhelming emotion writing my book was joy, because I was so happy that I was telling my grandmother's story and I was giving voice to the people that had made this place possible, which had made her life possible. And there were some overwhelming moments when I realized when I realized what I was writing. Oh, I'm writing about this man, you know, who held my grandmother's hand, you know, at some point. And so for me, anything that was overwhelming was just realizing that how monumental the story was to my own family. So it really was just sort of this project of joy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we want to, I am looking at time, but we're okay. Do we want to ask about editing? Oh, did you have a question?
I have another question.
Okay. Chip has a question.
Let's start with you, Jane. You know, we talk sometimes about writer's block. Do you ever get writer's block, you know? But the question I'm going to add, I'm going to change a little bit and see, you ever get a writing impasse? You know, you don't know whether you want to put this in or you, should I put it in or would it offend somebody? I assume you might have had one of those experiences.
Maybe I did on this, particular book, The Pink Dress, but then I decided I don't care. I just went after it. Yeah. I did. And on my newest work, which is on a biography on Marianne Goodnight, there's definitely some parts that I cannot put in. I mean, either the family has asked me or I just cannot put it in. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The writer makes that judgment, I think. We make that judgment when we're writing.
you each had to have done a fair amount of research. And so this is a question, but you each have a very short amount of time to answer it. So Lynn, I'm going to start with you for the research that you did. And also because you're, of the three of you, you're really an archivist. And I'm so interested in how one approaches working with an archive.
Well, the short version is the only reason I was able to write my book is because the person in charge of the Arequipa property, after it closed, it went under the purview of the Girl Scouts, found the entire archive of the sanatorium in the building and put it in a shed because he thought it looked important. And so when I went there in 1984, I said, do you have any old historical records? And he opens up the shed and there it is. So I bullied the Girl Scouts into letting me take everything home to organize it. And this one man making one decision saved the entire archive of this place, which is now at the University of California's Bancroft Library, because I bullied the Girl Scouts into giving it to them, made my book possible. I could have written Grandma's story, but having the entire archive, of course, made the book really possible.
Yeah. And Janelle, you had shared the other night in doing your research, you found some very interesting things happening as you went to confirm what you'd found earlier. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I had been looking for other patient testimonies to confirm some of the stories that she said. And I had early on printed as many of them out as I could, put them in a binder, everything organized. And when I got back to finishing the book and creating the bibliography, they were disappearing. Those websites were taken down. Those testimonies were taken down. The documents were removed from repositories. And I don't know, but I do know that the asylum hospital was not comfortable with some of the stories we shared. They said, you know, if you put that out there, people will believe that it's true. And I said, oh yeah, like an eyewitness account. And so that kind of happened in the same time frame. And I just find that suspicious, a little sus, that other eyewitness testimonies were being taken down. So that was a challenge for me. Thank God I printed it. Save your hard copy somewhere.
Startling. We're going to take one final break, and that is to tell you about one of our other sponsors, which is our business, outwestshop.com. When we come back, Miss Jane is going to read something from her book. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer. Jane is going to want to read a little something from the book. Right.
Yesterday too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yay. I think that whenever we write nonfiction, I don't like to even use the word setting. I like to use the word landscape or panorama because you have to have that behind you on any type of nonfiction book. I'm going to try to be fast on this, but it's a lot of words. Like other university campuses across the country in 1971, I'm not going to start there. I'm going to cut that out because of time. How about that? I had not been a rebel, at least not yet, but rather an extraordinarily obedient daughter who veered fearing out of her mother's orbit. Possibly my mother decided that I would sneak out a window to meet a boyfriend, spending all night out, something she later admitted doing herself. Or possibly she worried that I would run amok, perhaps to Juarez, Mexico. There I might sit with my friends in a circle around an ancient table with scarred chairs, cracked upholstery pricking my back just inside a door near the curve of the Kentucky bars or Kentucky Club's polished bar. We might play buzz and drink shots, and our brains becoming fuzzy each time someone, their tongues thick like cotton, failed to buzz a multiple of 7 or 11 or any number with 7 in it. Mother probably feared my walking back down Avenida Juarez, past dark entrance bars and strip clubs, their neon lights flashing, and loud music pumping from speakers with hawkers inviting us inside. Hey, girly, venga, venga adentro, come inside. She might have worried that I would stop under a sign at Fred's Bar to eat ham and avocado of unknown origin in a sandwich wrapped in a Mexican bolillo and purchased from a ragged street vendor. And inside the doorway, college students and Fort Bliss soldiers would leer and laugh too loudly while we moved on, stepping over litter that stank of decay and debauchery. Perhaps Mother feared that two pennies might elude my clumsy fingers in the bottom of my bag as I frantically tried to find coins to buy my way home through the turnstile gate at the Santa Fe Bridge, even as the person behind me, dodging a splatter of vomit, would ask, "Anyone got change?" I decided my mother had been afraid of me becoming her.
That's quite a passage. It just goes on and on. So wonderfully written, Jane. Well, now we really are looking at time, and I want to be sure that you each have a moment to tell us what's your next project and where can people find you. Go ahead, Jane. We'll just go ahead and start with you.
I just finished my maps today. My newest book is called The Breath of a Buffalo, a biography of Mary Ann Goodnight. Mary Ann Goodnight is the person responsible for saving the Southern Plains bison herd. She had four calves in 1878 when there were only 500 buffalo left in the entire United States. The book will be out. I'm hoping it's going to be out before October 1 next year. You don't release a book fourth quarter. And if they can't make that at the University of Oklahoma Press, it'll probably be in the spring of 27, which doesn't make me real happy, but doing the best we can.
Yeah.
Very good.
And Lynn, on to you.
I am researching and studying a diary that they have at the archives of the Arizona Historical Society in Tucson. A woman named Maud Buchholz left her home in Indiana in 1902 to go to Arizona because she was afraid she was going to get tuberculosis. And she left this wonderful diary behind, which I am researching, and I will be writing an article for a historical journal. I love Maud. She's my new favorite girl.
Yeah.
Very good.
Janelle, what have you got going on?
I am wrapping up my very first Arizona history book about ostrich ranching called Birds Gone Wild. And it is a pop history, irreverent and sassy, because who can talk about ostriches with a straight face? Come on. And I'm hoping that will come out in time for a January release. Also, you can find me at JanelleMaloney.com, on the socials, author Janelle Maloney, or on YouTube. You can find me at The Hottie Historian.
You can see why she's younger than us. We didn't think to say that.
We forgot that part, Jane. LynnDowney.com.
Okay. And all three of you return October 30th in just 2 weeks. And our theme is going to be Women Were There. And I'm sure we'll hear more about the projects that maybe that you're working on or some stories from other books that we'll be talking about. American Dude Ranch with Of course, we know that Jane will talk more about the Goodnight book coming up. And with Janelle, Emigrant Trails of the Platte River Raid. So we have a lot of reading to do in the next
week. Oh, my goodness.
So thank you.
There'll be no dinner tonight.
Thank you, all of you Hottie historians, for
thank
being
you.
With us tonight. We really appreciate your time and your talent and your enthusiasm. And next week, we will have a cozy murder mystery author with us. This is the 10th in her series. Mary Seifert will be with us, and we'll be talking about Airplanes, Atlanta, and an Assassin. And that's in just next week. And Jane, I forgot to hold this book up. Jane is also a short story writer. She had a fabulous book in this anthology. She was with us earlier this year, Through Western Storms. And I just hadn't, I tried to come equipped.
We have a lot of books here.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is episode 157. It'll replay in just a moment. Jim, you have any common final thoughts?
as we always say, it's always a great day out west.
Keep writing.
And we'll keep reading.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Have a good
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.